Let's dive back into our look at the temple being built by Solomon, designed by David at the direction of the Holy Spirit. We've already dealt with the building of the main sanctuary building, the place where worship happens, including the great big tower at the front of it. We're now going to talk about a lot of the things on the outside of the temple and how they fit into the complex. Remember, there's some sort of barrier enclosing wall all around the temple complex to keep people out unless they go through the front gate. And so now let's just expand on our idea of what all this looked like. Some of the stuff is really hard for us to verbalize it. It's better when we can see it. But rendering even that becomes difficult because we don't have some of the fine details provided here. Because, well, there was a guy that took care of all those fine details and they didn't get written down. In fact, let's open to 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 13 as our starting point. And remember that we're also taking materials from 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and onward as parallel. So 1 Kings 7:13 reminds us of something we already talked about, and that is King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. Now, this is not King Hiram. This is Hiram, who is part Phoenician, part Israeli. He was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. Now, we didn't know his mom was dead before. Now we do. So mom was an Israeli from up north, the borderlands with the region of Tyre. Naphtali territory is north and west from the Sea of Galilee, and that's also the same direction Tyre is from the Sea of Galilee. So dad's apparently raised him in his own speciality, which is working in bronze. Hiram, though, expanded into all sorts of other areas of fabrication, because we know that King Hiram was asked by Solomon to provide somebody with expertise across all sorts of materials used in building grand projects. And this guy was sent. We are told in the rest of verse 14, he was full of wisdom, understanding, and skill for making any work in bronze. Actually, the same wording is used to say that he could work in wood and stone and in jewels, fabric. He was just really gifted and skilled across a wide variety of manufacture. So he came to King Solomon and did all his work. He cast two pillars of bronze. We mentioned these last time. 18 cubits was the height of one pillar. And so we talked about the fact that the number 35 shows up in the Chronicles passage, but it seems to be an estimation of the height of both pillars together, because it used the number 35. When you take 18 times 2, you get 36, so we're very close to the 35 number. So 18 cubits, which when you use the long cubit, which we know is the one used in the construction here, that's just over 31 feet. The line of 12 cubits measured its circumference. So all the way around, it was 20 feet 7 inches, 20 feet 8.4 inches. I think that's the inside measurement. Just my guess. It was hollow. And its thickness was 4 fingers. Now, if you look at your hand, your open hand, across your 4 fingers, they're at the base of them. That's about 3.5 inches for most adult men. So that's what we're talking about here. That's pretty thick. And then he also made 2 capitals of cast bronze to set on the tops of the pillars. The height of the one capital was 5 cubits, and the height of the other capital was 5 cubits. And these seem to be in the shape of lilies, open-blossomed lilies, and they would snug down over the top of the tapered pillar. And I believe that once these two components came together, that the finished product was roughly 20 cubits tall. And I think that matches the building so that there was a good, these towers, these columns, become solid load-bearing pillars for the tower that comes up across above them. I know that there's a lot of scholars that believe these were freestanding, and I don't. I think that they were both beautiful, but they were also practical, that they were load-bearing. There were lattices of checkered work with wreaths of chainwork for the capitals on the tops of the pillars, a lattice from one capital and a lattice for the other capital. I told you, I think this is basically very fancy bird netting to keep the birds from nesting inside of that fine decorative work. You could still see it through this very fine netting, but the birds couldn't get to it. A little bit more design description. Likewise, he made pomegranates in 2 rows around the one lattice work to cover the capital that was on the top of the pillar, and he did the same with the other capital. Pragmatically, I think the pomegranates may have been providing the weight that kept the netting down and against these capitals to keep the birds from getting up underneath and nesting in there. Now, the capitals that were on the tops of the pillars in the vestibule were of lily work, 4 cubits. So they probably had a base for the decoration of the open flower of a lily. And so the lily itself was probably 4 cubits, and then a little 5-cubit base that helped to snug down over the top of the tapered open pillar. The capitals were on the 2 pillars and also above the rounded projection that was beside the lattice work. There were 200 pomegranates in 2 rows all around, and so with the other capital. So that's a lot of pomegranates, probably designed in casting to really give this fine detail. He set up the pillars at the vestibule of the temple. Vestibule is used here as a description of this front porch area that was the entry to the holy place where the priests went to work every day. He set up the pillar on the south and called its name Yakin, and set up the pillar on the north and called its name Boaz, which together they form a sentence: he shall establish in strength. And on the tops of the pillars was lily work. Thus, the work of the pillars was finished. Now, these pillars, like all of the bronze work, are going to be cast far away from Jerusalem, down in the Jordan Valley. They use clay that's readily available down there to cast these things, probably used the ancient method of wax that will eventually melt and leave a hollow spot. The best way I understand it is that you would make a column of clay, probably using clay bricks, and then you would trim it around into a column to the shape that you wanted as the hollow core, and then smooth it out. And then you would pack wax around that clay pillar to the depth that you wanted the bronze to be. And in this case, it's one hand breadth, so 3.5 inches. Down underneath, there would be channels underneath where the wax ended, down at the base, because what would happen next is you would then put a shell of clay around that wax. And then this would all be happening in some sort of kiln building. They would heat the building up to a high temperature, and this would do two things. It would melt the wax and let the wax run away as a liquid, leaving a void between the two baked columns of clay. And so you've got now a fireproof mold into which you would pour the molten bronze, let it set, let it cool down, and then you would just chip away the outside clay and pull up, probably using a hoist, to pull up that great big hollow pillar of bronze. And if you're good at it, I would imagine it would leave the inner column of clay intact. And then you could do the process again to make your second pillar. And so this is probably how these pillars were made. Then a similar technique was used for every other thing that they make out of bronze. The next bronze thing that they make in 1 Kings 7:23 is what's referred to as the sea of cast metal. And this sea, actually, before we go to that, let's make a little notation about another thing of bronze that's just mentioned briefly in the Second Chronicles passage. So let me go to 2 Chronicles 4. 2 Chronicles 4, 1, he made an altar of bronze, 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 10 cubits high. So we know that we had a bronze altar that was part of the tabernacle that traveled with them through the wilderness, and then it got situated into the promised land wherever the tabernacle was at. This is similar to that, but bigger. It is 34.5 feet squared, and it has an open area inside of it. And then it's 10 cubits tall. So it's 17.25 feet tall. That is a big barbecue. And then there'll be grated, there'll be metal grates that will be suspended inside of that. That will be the massive sacrificial altar out in the forecourt later. All right. Since we're in 2 Chronicles now, let's continue talking about the sea, or what we probably refer to as a water tank, the main water tank. Verse 2, then he made the sea of cast metal. It was round, 10 cubits from brim to brim. So it's 17.25 feet across. And then it has a line of 30 cubits measuring its circumference. So 30 cubits, that's 51.75 feet around. And you have to take in consideration how thick it is as to how the diameter versus perimeter works in your measurements. Under it were figures of gourds for 10 cubits compassing the sea all around. So that's a little side decoration going down from the top. And they're in, when you go a little bit farther, it says that the gourds were in two rows cast with it when it was cast. So when they build their missing wax mold, because the idea is you use the wax to form the void that the molten bronze is going to be poured into, they made sure that they designed these gourds into the outside of this big bowl that we're going to be calling the sea. And so it stood on 12 oxen, also made of bronze, by the way. I presume that these are full size. So pretty good sized oxen. They'll probably be hollow. We know that the ancient workers in bronze typically cast their big figures, like full size figures, as hollow. And so maybe make them in a half and then welded them together and then covered up the welds with the finishing work. But they make 12 of these oxen. Why? 12 tribes of Israel, obviously. 3 were facing the north, and I think they were probably in a straight line. 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. The sea was set on them, and all their rear parts were inward. So they were basically in three sections. Well, four different groups of three. And their bottoms were facing inward, their faces facing outward. And once all of this stuff is cast and ready to go, the hemisphere of the sea, the bowl shape of the sea, was lowered down so that it was seated on the hindquarters of these 12 bulls. And then it was probably spot welted into place in the way that they did it back there. Maybe soldering is probably the better choice that I would use for the words here. And so its thickness, that is the thickness of this big bowl, was again a hand breadth, so about 3.5 inches. The brim was made like the brim of a cup, like the flower of a lily. So again, it folded outward. It held 3,000 baths of water. Now, we have a different number in another place, and I can't remember. Yeah, it's right over here. It's in 1 Kings chapter 7, verse number 26. It says it held 2,000 baths. I'm guessing that the difference between the two is whether you filled it to the brim or filled it most of the way, which would probably be the typical way of doing it. Because this would have been done by probably some sort of piping system. They knew how to do siphon pumps and things like that. So 3,000 baths, which I believe is the maximum amount it could hold. That's 18,000 gallons of water. Because there's about 6 baths, roughly, six gallons in each bath. Now, that's a lot of water. That's about 40 tons of water. Think about that. And so this is the water supply tank that is needed to supply all of the daily activities in the temple courtyard, because they're going to be sacrificing a lot of animals day by day. And that requires a lot of washing away of blood from those butchered animals and a lot of cleaning of the priest's hands and feet that have been involved in that process, and even the cleaning of the clothes because of all of that blood and gore. And so you're going to go through an awful lot of water. And so this tank holds an awful lot of water and is refilled on a regular basis. Interestingly enough, just as a side note here, one of the things that Pontius Pilate and the Jews of his day got into an argument over is that there was so much water being used in Jerusalem that Pontius Pilate decided that they needed to have another aqueduct system built to bring more water into the city. And since the Jerusalem temple was a major consumer of water, he felt that the temple should foot an awful lot of that bill. The Jewish religious leadership said, no, we're not paying a penny or not paying a shekel. And Pilate said, no, you're paying. And so he actually sent some of his soldiers into the temple complex to the treasury area and confiscated funds to pay for that project. And that caused a riot, as you might expect, and some people died. And Jesus seems to be asked a question about that during his ministry, about those whose blood was spilt by Pilate in the temple complex. Jesus' response is intriguing. He says, you think these people were worse sinners than others? You think the people whom the Tower of Siloam fell on recently, they're worse sinners than others? I'm telling you that you need to repent lest something even worse happen to you. Just an interesting application of current events by Jesus. Back to our story here about the Solomon Temple. Verse number 6 of 2 Chronicles 4 says that he also made 10 basins in which to wash. So these are basins that are going to be wheeled around to provide more localized water supply. And he set 5 of them on the south side of the temple building, 5 on the north side of the temple building. In these, they were to rinse off what was used for the burnt offering, and then the sea was for the priests to wash in. Now, I doubt that the priests climbed up and got into the great big water tank. More than likely, there was some sort of spigot system, some sort of fountain system, perhaps even constantly running, that provided the place for the priests to wash off in there at the big sea that was on the back of the bulls. These other water tanks were strategically arranged for the butchering areas where they skinned and gutted and cut up the sacrificial animals before they were taken up onto that bronze altar to be burned up, or parts of them taken off to the kitchen area to be cooked up. We have more details about these water tanks on the north and south side in 1 Kings. Let's go there as we're kind of finishing up today. 1 Kings 7, verse 27. He also made the 10 stands of bronze. Each stand was 4 cubits long, 4 cubits wide, 3 cubits high. So 4 cubits is 6.9 feet. And so that's squared. So this is a framework that's almost 7 foot square. And then it's 3 foot or three cubits high. That's just a little over 5 feet tall. So this is not a small stand. It's a framework that these big water tanks are going to be placed in. On the panels that were set on the frames were lions, oxen, and cherubim. So they're decorated on the sides. On the frames, both above and below the lions and oxen, there are wreaths of beveled work. So it's very decorative. Moreover, each stand had four bronze wheels and axles of bronze. And at the four corners were supports for a basin. So these stands were wheeled, probably big chariot-style wheels on them, so that they could be rolled around as needed to different places. The supports were cast with wreaths at the side of each. Its opening was within a crown that projected upward 1 cubit. Its opening was round as a pedestal is made, 1.5 cubits deep. So that's the place at the top where these big tanks are going to be dropped into. Its opening were carvings, and its panels were square, not round. The four wheels were underneath the panels. The axles of the wheels were of one piece with the stands, and the height of the wheel was 1.5 cubits. So that's 2.5 feet, basically. And the wheels were made like chariot wheels, like I said, and their axles and their rims, their spokes, and their hubs were all cast. Before we close up, though, we'll come back to this, but I want to let you know that each of these water tanks, these portable water tanks, would have held about 1 ton of water because a lot of water was needed around the temple building in order to support the sacrificial work each and every day. And so we'll get into those details the next time we have opportunity to come back. So mark your place. I'll see you next time we get into God's Word.